morning. We're delighted to welcome students from the Stockbridge School. Would you please stand? Thank you for coming. You may be seated. The students are here with a national award-winning program that is sponsored by this court and by the State Bar of Wisconsin. With this program, we invite students across the state to join us for an oral argument. If the student accepts the invitation, they are sent material about the case and asked to come to Madison, listen to the oral argument, and they meet with a justice who has been assigned for that day to meet with students. The discussion is usually held right after the second case, and the discussion is on the procedures of the court in accepting and deciding cases. It is not on the substantive issue of the case the students hears. Today I was the assigned justice for the quote lunchtime conversation, but we ran overtime in the first oral argument, and the students will not be able to spend time here at that. But if the students have written questions or want responses to comments, I'd be very happy to do that in writing and in an email to the students. So it's up to you to send in questions if you would like responses. Looks like too large a group for a telephone conference call. But we might be able to arrange video. We haven't done that for a while, so we may try to do that. Having introduced the students, let me introduce the members of the court. Starting on my far right is Justice Annette Ziegler. Seated next to her is Justice David Prosser. To my immediate right is Justice Ann Walsh Bradley. I'm Shirley Abrahamson, the Chief Justice. To my immediate left is Justice Patrick Crooks. Next to Justice Crooks is Justice Patience Rogan-Sack. And on the far left is Justice Michael Gableman. With the introductions made, I'll call our second case, which is 2012 AP 2085, Kelly Brandenburg versus Robert, is it Luthi? And arguing on behalf of the insurance company and Mr. Luthi is attorney W. Thomas Terwilliger. Mr. Terwilliger, the podium is yours.
For the record, my name is Tom Terwilliger, and I do represent Robert Luthi and McMillan Warner Mutual Insurance Company in this matter. The defendant, Robert Luthi, is a retired attorney who has no employees and owns 22 acres of land adjacent to the plaintiff Brandenburg's property. Luthi's home and pasture are located on that property. In May or June of 2008, Mr. Luthi wanted to remove from his property an invasive species known as prickly ash for aesthetic reasons and because the prickly ash was interfering with his growth of grass as well as prevented difficulty for him to locate cattle that were pastured there. In order to eradicate the prickly ash, he visited the county forester, and the county forester recommended that he talked to the defendant defendant Briarwood, to discuss a application of herbicide. Mr. Luthi met with Briarwood's owner, Brian Borison, at the property. Borison told Luthi the herbicide would kill the prickly ash, but would not hurt the trees or the grass. Borison did not advise Luthi of any particular or special risks with using the herbicide. Luthi had not worked with herbicide at any time previously on his property.
Mr. Terwilliger, it seems to me that what you're doing is you're reciting facts in regard to the case, and that brings up a question that I think I'd like to have out sooner rather than later, which is based in part on the circuit court's procedure during the summary judgment hearing where it set a fact-finding hearing to determine whether this was an inherently dangerous activity or an extra hazardous or not. And it determined after the factual finding that it was not. I mean, it was a little unclear exactly what he determined, either extra hazardous or inherently dangerous, because I think the circuit court used one at the beginning and one at the end. And now the Court of Appeals has applied the facts. It seems to me that the Court of Appeals has applied the facts and has made a legal determination that the conduct here was inherently dangerous. Are we being asked to address a factual question, or are we being asked to address just whether there's enough to survive summary judgment, or how would you address that?
You're being asked to do two things in this case. Number one, you're being asked to determine in this case that Mr. Luthi's, the application of the herbicide in Mr. Luthi's case, is not inherently dangerous because he did not have knowledge of peculiar risk that resulted in the harm in this case. So it does not meet the test under the restatement as fully applied.
You're asking us to find as a matter of law.
Yes. Now, additionally, we're asking that the court take a look at whether or not it makes sense to apply the exception to the independent contractor rule that a homeowner could be responsible for inherently dangerous activities. As you and I know, when you hire somebody to do work around your house, you're hiring them because, one, you can't do it yourself, and you don't know what the peculiar risks are to that particular application.
So that's the part, then, that we're being asked to determine whether survives the summary judgment.
Right. We're not asking you to overrule any cases. We're asking you to simply hold, because this court has never applied, to our knowledge, the exception to the independent contractor rule to a mere property owner or a homeowner. Yet the case that was applied by the ruling of the Court of Appeals basically makes all homeowners at risk for the application of this rule whenever they hire independent contractors. So, for instance, if you hire someone to make an addition on your house, that's inherently dangerous.
I promise we'll probably talk about all sorts of hypotheticals. But before we do that, do you agree or disagree that as a matter of law, the application of herbicide is an inherently dangerous activity?
If we're dealing with a governmental agency or a business, I believe the answer to that is yes. But when you're dealing with a property owner, I think the answer to that is no, because the property owner does not have the knowledge of the special precautions or the risk that is not commonly known.
I'm just thinking out loud now here. Wouldn't those be two separate questions? Two separate questions, and one that a court could determine as a matter of law, the other that would go to each particular fact pattern. Maybe you have a property owner. I mean, he's a retired attorney, and maybe there are some members of this bench who have places elsewhere, but maybe there are other people who are herbicide specialists or experts in the field of application of herbicide. Wouldn't it call for a case-by-case analysis as opposed to a blanket rule?
I think there should be a rule, and the exception should be if the property owner, if the individual homeowner had knowledge of the particular risk, then maybe that could be the exception. But as a general rule, all people in the state of Wisconsin are now exposed to vicarious liability whenever they hire an independent contractor to do work for them. I mean, that's the problem.
You'd feel differently if, for example, he went down to the True Value hardware store and bought this off the shelf and decided he was going to go spray his lawn with it. Then do you think he'd be responsible?
Well, he's the person who did the work, and he's the person who didn't follow the label instructions. In this case, Luthi didn't know anything about application. He didn't know what herbicide was going to apply. He wasn't given the label instructions. He knew absolutely nothing. He didn't know there was even a problem until after the fact. So it's not a case where he's actually doing the work. He's hiring a independent contractor to do the work. Yet we're being held potentially responsible, and our personal assets potentially responsible, for that negligence of the independent contractor. I mean, the risk in this case is that when the ambient temperature rises above a certain degree, the droplets volatilize, rise up, and can drift. That's what happened. Nobody has ever said that we knew anything about volatilization of a herbicide.
Aren't there other factors, though? I mean, you said one, but I thought I read about thickening agents and...
Oh, those are... Yes, you can use thickening agents. You can apply it with a tighter nozzle so that it's...
Just didn't want to leave the misimpression that you were telling us that there was one factor.
No, there's applying herbicides, like everything else in life, requires a lot of skill and expertise and knowledge, which the ordinary layman has no knowledge of, which our guy had no knowledge of.
So when you say something is inherently dangerous, that always makes me focus on the activity, but you're combining with the activity the knowledge of the actor, right?
The knowledge
of
the risk,
it's a little bit different than I had thought about it before. Given where we are in this case, if the Court of Appeals is upheld and an activity is inherently dangerous and you hire an independent contractor for it, just removal of asbestos. You buy an old house, it's got all the stuff in the basement wrapped with asbestos. Everybody knows that's a bad thing to remove, and you hire people that wear suits all over them and goggles and the whole shot. So if the Court of Appeals is right and you hire a guy to remove the asbestos from the basement of your old house, and somehow it gets airborne and some other people that are nearby are harmed by that, they can sue you even though the guy was an independent contractor, right?
Well, the answer to that is yes. However, you might not be liable because you're only responsible for risks that are peculiar, which are not known by the common public. In other words,
maybe it's people that live next door that don't know about the risks of asbestos. They don't have any in their house. Why should they be so concerned about what you know?
Well, it's who is what does the owner know? In other words, what does the person who hires the independent contractor know?
Yeah, so just say you know that asbestos is dangerous, but you hire someone who is certified to remove asbestos. You can get sued now, correct?
Well, the answer is you can get sued. The question is whether or not there will be liability attached, which will depend on why it occurred.
Okay. And what's your rule of law as to whether liability attaches under the fact situation given by the hypothetical given by Justice Rogensack?
My rule of law, which I ask the court to adopt, is that the independent contractor exception does not apply to homeowners or property owners, that it apply only to business and governmental agencies, businesses that have employees and regularly are involved in hiring independent contractors.
But by saying that, I hear that the general law, and in the restatement, is that somebody who hires an independent contractor to perform an inherently dangerous job becomes liable if that job is performed negligently. That's the general rule. As I hear it, you're asking for an exception here and say, no, don't apply the general rule if you're dealing with a homeowner or a property owner. Only apply this general rule about liability for independent contractors if it's the government that hires the independent contractor or a business, right?
Well,
is that what you're proposing?
That's what we're proposing, but
can I
basically...
Can I ask you a question before you tell that? What was Luthi's business? Didn't he run cattle?
He was a hobby farmer. He had cattle that he would buy
hobby
and sell.
Hobby farmer, how do you define hobby farmer? The way the Internal Revenue Service defines it?
I'm sorry.
How do you define hobby farmer? The way the IRS defines it?
I define hobby farm as something that's not a business. That's something just they just do it for pleasure.
How many cattle did he have?
It would vary from 40 to maybe as many as 300, depending upon where it is.
Mm-hmm. What did he do with them? Sell them for?
Basically, he would
raise
dry cows and wait until they would be in time when they could freshen, and then he'd give them to somebody who wanted to milk them.
He gave them away, made no money on it.
Gave them in the sense of sold them.
Sold them. Okay. Just wanted to know. So you would say even if we adopted your rule, he's not a business person.
He's not a business person.
Okay.
He doesn't have regular employees.
Okay. Now tell me why you think your rule is a good one that the court should adopt.
I think my rule is a good one because I think it recognizes the way it is in today's society. We're an agrarian society no longer. We are homeowners that do not have special knowledge or information and are incapable of doing it. I mean, if you take a look at the rationales for the rule, none of them, I think, particularly apply. To argue and to suggest that a landowner is in a position to evaluate risks and exercise good judgment when selecting a contractor, I think is.
And that's not the charge here that necessarily that he negligently selected.
Right.
If he negligently selected, that doesn't come under the inherent dangerous rule.
Right. And there's
that's
no,
a separate one. So,
and there's no claim that there was negligent hiring in this case.
This is just an inherent dangerous rule.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay.
I was talking about the justifications for the inherent danger rule.
Okay.
And one of them is that all the landowner has to do is evaluate the risk and exercise good judgment in selecting the contractor who is solvent and fully insured. However, that's easy to say, but is impractical to use in the real world.
Well, it's interesting you would use the choice of words impractical. It seems to me that you're asking us to carve out an exception to the exception. General non-liability, liability if inherently dangerous, but no liability if a homeowner or, I think you said, property owner, right?
Yes.
All right. So that brings me back to my original question, which is, what if that homeowner happens to be the owner of an herbicide application business? Who decides?
I think that would probably be a fact question for the jury to decide.
Okay, so what if the homeowner or property owner is not, that occupation, but has many years of experience applying herbicide, perhaps grew up on a farm, not necessarily in the business, but knows a lot about it. Then what happens?
Well, I think the test is whether or not they have knowledge of the peculiar risk, which is a risk that is not known to the general public. I think
how do you determine? How do we determine that as a court system?
I think it's difficult to apply. As you read the cases, it's difficult to apply.
One might say impractical. But
pardon?
One might say impractical, but I'm waiting for you to educate.
A thousands could. I'm not sure I would, but yes.
Sure. So who decides? I mean, what does that look like? How does that play out in the real world?
I think in the real world, you're ultimately going to have some of these things are going to be jury questions, I think. It's probably, but I mean, the exception has to be there for that even to be.
All right, so it goes through discovery? Is that how you would see it? It would go through discovery and depositions, and then the opposing counsel would test the homeowner or property owner's defendant's knowledge and experience with. In this case, it happens to be herbicide.
Right.
Okay.
Right.
Okay,
that's
so
what I think.
If I understand you, what you're saying in response to Justice Gableman's question is that you decide whether something is inherently dangerous by the product you're looking at and the knowledge of the person who hires an independent contractor to deal with the product.
Yes.
Okay. So doesn't the word inherent encompasses the knowledge of the person doing the hiring of the independent contractor as well as the qualities of the product?
Yes. I mean, you have to, the restatement, I believe, provides liability for only peculiar risks of which he knew about.
Just, oh, I'm sorry. Justice Rogan said.
Okay, you know, I'm confused. Thank you. Thank you.
Now I'm confused because I thought you answered in response to my question that you are asking us to carve out an exception to the exception. Now, in my mind, I go in a linear fashion and I say, okay, what's the general rule? General rule, no liability. What's the exception to the rule? The exception to the rule that we're focusing in on today is inherently dangerous. And there's already a set amount of factors that are to be considered by a court is to determine whether something is inherently dangerous. And I think you've told me that you do not dispute the Court of Appeals' conclusion as a matter of law that the application of herbicide is an inherently dangerous activity. But then maybe you tagged on to it what Justice Rogensack was asking you about, which is it depends.
That's exactly right. Right. I mean, if you're asking, you know, in the abstract, is herbicide application of this sort inherently dangerous? The answer to that question is, but the question before the court is whether or not the exception to the independent contractor rule should be applied to a private residence, a property owner. That's the issue, and we're saying it doesn't make any sense. It's never been applied to cases that we can find. No court has ever applied the exception to the independent contractor rule to a private individual, a fellow who's a resident or a property owner. And the reason why is that the underlying basis for the arguments don't apply to a private individual. I mean, a private individual cannot evaluate the solvency of the contractor that he's hiring. An independent contractor cannot evaluate the insurance policy that the independent contractor holds. In this case,
Mr. Williger, first of all, there's nothing wrong with my hearing. I can hear you just fine. Second of all, I'm not disputing or I'm not questioning you about the logic of your position. I'm just trying to determine what it is and how it plays out. And I understand your focus is properly on your client. But as a court, our focus has to be not only on the parties here, but on parties to come. And I'm just trying to work out how, in your proposed scenario, the circuit court is to govern the proceedings so as to properly apply the law. That's all I'm asking at this point.
Okay. Here's our position. The law should be that the independent contractor exception does not apply if the principal employer or the owner is a residential owner or a single property owner without employees who doesn't regularly engage in hiring independent contractors.
Regardless of what he knows or doesn't know, and regardless of whether the court thinks it's inherently dangerous, right?
Well, I was going to continue.
Okay.
The exception to that rule would be if indeed that owner had knowledge of the particular risk that resulted in the harm, that would be an exception to that rule.
So that's a subjective test?
Yes.
Not an objective test?
I think so, yes.
Okay.
Mr. Twilliger, I'm still somewhat confused after listening to your responses to counsel, especially, I think, to Justice Gableman. The whole idea of whether an activity is inherently dangerous, do you believe that that's a determination that can be made, as the Court of Appeals did, as a matter of law, or do you feel that that's a factual determination to be made by the trier of fact?
I think it may depend on the circumstances. The reason why I said yes to this, because I'm aware there are cases, not this case, but other cases that have held that application of this type of herbicide is inherently dangerous. So I didn't want to suggest that there weren't cases. I'm saying in this case, though, there should be an exception.
So you're saying that it might be a determination that can be made as a matter of law or a determination as a matter of fact, depending on the overall circumstances?
I think so, yes. I would not want to say without having given a great deal of thought to it, that there's a general rule to that. But no, I think it should be.
No, your response I find interesting, because to me there's a foundational question that sits underneath this, which is, just say it's an inherently dangerous activity. Even if it's an inherently dangerous activity, we've never said, well, then independent contractors are liable for it. I mean, there's a whole space that's in between where the law is today and where your argument takes off at. Am I making any sense to you? Not much.
I didn't follow you. I mean, the question is whether or not the homeowner is going to be vicariously liable for the negligent acts of the
independent
contractors. That's the
right.
Question.
Yes.
And what you have never done is you've never applied that rule
right.
to a private homeowner.
Okay. And we've also never said that you get around the independent contractor's independence just because an activity is inherently dangerous. Where's our case that says that?
Wait a minute. Ask me that question again, because I did not follow that.
Has a Wisconsin appellate court ever said, if an activity is inherently dangerous, then you can sue the person who hires an independent contractor? Period.
Yes.
What about Wofford? What case?
I think.
Which case?
I think Wagner. I think the whole laundry list of cases we cited stand for that proposition.
That if it's inherently dangerous, you can get under the independent contractor rule.
Yes.
No. Okay. All right.
So, and Lofty is a good example, right?
I know. Lofty, I read it maybe a little differently, but that's fine.
Okay. Asking this court to make an exception to the generally. First, you start off with the principle that a person who hires an independent contractor is not vicariously liable for the contractor's negligence. That's the first principle. The second principle is there's an exception if it's inherently dangerous. And you're asking that we make an exception to the exception that the inherently dangerous doctrine only applies only if it's not a business. If it's not a business, if it's a personal individual, you don't have an exception.
Right. It does not apply to an individual.
Right.
Resident, individual property owner. It only should apply to businesses or governmental agencies.
Justice Rogensack prefaced her question as something foundational. And I have a foundational question also. Has it been determined here whether your client is a business as opposed to a private resident or landowner? What causes me concern is 40 to 300 cows.
Pets.
Yeah, that's a lot of indoor pets.
There has not been a determination. That all the briefs were written from both sides that he's a private individual, not a business or a...
The focus in the circuit court, and I guess on appeal, and of course here, is inherently dangerous in the restatement and the rule and the exception to the exception. But that foundational question, what do we do with that?
Well, I think what you do is you write the decision, assuming he's a property owner, is the way you write the decision. And then address the issue of whether or not there should, in fact, be the exception to the rule that you're vicariously liable for the tortious acts of your independent contractors when you're dealing with a simple property owner who he doesn't have employees, he doesn't regularly hire independent contractors. I mean, we're pretty far removed from, quote, business or government that has lots of employees, has the ability to, you know, to know what they don't know. You know, a landowner, we don't know very much anymore as a society about the risks of what the independent contractor is doing.
Well, on a happy note, though, we don't know anything.
About building additions onto houses and doing excavation and things like that.
All right.
Shingling the roof.
Who takes care of 300
Justice
cows?
Justice Prosser has a question, apparently.
They just are out in the field. They're not freshened animals, so they're just out in the field. They eat the grass, and that's what he does with them. He just pastures them.
No one takes care of them.
No
one takes care of them.
No one basically takes care of them, no.
They never come back to a barn?
No.
It's fenced.
A fence, right. There's a fence. Basically, Luthy's involvement with this case, other than hiring Briarwood, was he showed Boreson where the fence was and said, when you're applying herbicide, there's the water. I mean, that's what we did. And he knows nothing about herbicides or the risks, the special, peculiar risks caused the harm.
You don't dispute paragraph 16 of the Court of Appeals opinion that sets forth the three principles. You want just another principle added to that.
Yes.
If I understand your argument.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Any other questions? Thank you. You do have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Arndt, representing Brandenburgs.
Thank you, Your Honor. For the record, my name is Dan Arndt. I have the privilege of representing Bruce and Kelly Brandenburg. May it please the Court, the essence of Leithy's argument for either overturning or modifying, modifying the well-established inherently dangerous activity exception to the non-liability for independent contractor rule is that it is not fair to place the burden of the risk of damage from that inherently dangerous activity onto an owner. However, it is a zero-sum game. Unfortunately, the law cannot make the burden disappear. It exists. If the law removes it from one party, it must place that same exact burden on the shoulder of another party. Leithy argues that the burden should be removed from an owner who ultimately authorized the activity, who had knowledge of the activity, who has a means of insuring against the risk of such activity, and who benefits from the activity, to another owner who has no knowledge of the activity, no ability to insure against the risk of the activity, no input in authorizing the activity, and does not benefit from the activity.
You're talking about your clients, the Brandenburgs.
Correct. Yes, the neighboring owner.
They were just sitting around there, and all of a sudden, they got a problem.
As the court noted in Wagner, the third-party victim in cases like this is largely a victim just by pure geography or happenstance. They happen to be there. They have absolutely no control over the activity. Now, if we're going to change this rule, Leithy has emphasized that there's been no case that has ever said that it was just an owner that's liable under this exception. First of all, we disagree with that. We think Carlson, the log floating case, that as far as we can tell from the facts, that was just an owner. Second, in our research of the entire restatement, we have not been able to find any case where it distinguishes between an owner and draws the line that Leithy is asking us to draw here.
So what you are asking us to do, if I'm hearing you accurately, is to continue with the general rule, with the exception to the general rule as it's expressed in Wagner, as quoted by the Court of Appeals here, where the Court of Appeals says, in order for an activity to be called inherently dangerous, two elements must be present. And the first is that the activity must pose a naturally expected risk of harm, and it must be possible to reduce the risk to a reasonable level by taking precautions.
Yes.
Okay. And so then, I almost hesitate to ask this, but do you think that an activity can be found inherently dangerous as a matter of law, or must that go to a fact finder?
I think, and to your question, Justice Gableman, and to Justice Crook's question previously, I think, as in general, most of the time, it's a fact question. I believe it is a fact question. For instance, in the case of construction, there have been cases that say, if you are if you are tearing down a wall right next to your neighbor's property, it's that proximity of that wall to the neighbor's property that causes the inherent danger. Extrapolating from that, if you're tearing down a wall in the middle of your own property, far from your neighbor's property, you wouldn't have that inherent danger. In this case, the reason that the Court of Appeals found that it is a matter of law is because the facts were undisputed that there was an inherent danger. And secondly, there is the law is that spraying insecticides or pesticides is inherently dangerous.
Where is that law formulated?
That law is found both in the case law in Bennett, and it is found in the statute that adopts the code, the administrative code section that we cite in our brief. I can give you that cite. It's administrative code 94.69 of the Agriculture, Trade, and Consumer Protection. So then that turns us right back to knowledge, because as this court knows, knowledge of the law is always imputed. You can't avoid negligence by saying we didn't have knowledge that this was an inherent risk or an inherently dangerous activity. Now, one thing that I have never understood, and I don't mean that in a disrespectful manner, Attorney Terwilliger is a fine attorney, I've never understood where it came from that the argument that the peculiar risk means that it's not known by the general population of humankind. That is not an element in inherently dangerous activity. The peculiar risk, peculiar means peculiar to the activity involved. So in this case where we have spraying, the peculiar risk is the spray drifting or volatilizing and causing damage elsewhere. It is not.
Counselor, if you're correct then, and I buy an old house, and it's got asbestos in the basement, and I know asbestos is dangerous, and I hire an independent contractor who is certified to take the asbestos out, and he performs it in a way that is not done properly, and it affects a neighbor of mine, then my neighbor can sue me, even though I hired someone to perform this service because I knew I had to have a specialist, right?
Correct.
Wow. I mean, that's quite a step.
Well, and that's, I think, the very purpose for the inherently dangerous exception is...
How do you ever protect yourself then? I mean, you hire someone who is certified to remove asbestos, and I think you have to, in fact. So you do that, and you still can get sued. So you might as well get somebody cheap and hope they do a good job?
Well, I mean, no, it would actually be the opposite, because... You would want somebody good, number one, so
yeah,
that
hopefully
you,
they'll do it right. Right.
Right.
I was just being silly. But
right.
Truthfully, if you try to follow the law and you hire someone that's certified and they don't do a good job, you can still get sued by any person that's affected by their lack of care, even though they're an independent contractor.
Correct. And I think your point is a very good one, because you do have two elements then, because you're still on the hook, or two things that you'd like to do. One is you'd like to hire somebody good to be sure that you don't ultimately end up on the hook. And then your other question was, could you protect yourself? The other way would be to hire a business that was reputable, had assets, and was properly insured. That's an opportunity.
But they could still sue me. Regardless of what their assets are, they still have a claim against me. So if I'm the person that's injured, I'm going to sue everybody that I can sue, because you never know where the pocket's going to be the biggest.
Is the claim...
Why don't we let you answer that question, okay?
The answer is right? You can still sue that person.
Right, but the point, though, is that you, as the owner that hired the independent contractor, are going to have the indemnification claim against the independent contractor. So you and your insurance company will not ultimately be on the hook if there is proper insurance for the contractor.
And when you're
isn't there another answer also? If you're not negligent, you might be sued, but you're not liable. Isn't that correct?
If the independent contractor is not negligent.
Right. You're sued for negligence.
Right. So that was my point as to why you'd want to hire someone reputable, that they'll do a good job, and then it won't flow through to you.
If I carelessly hire an independent contractor, I can see I have independent negligence. But what you're saying is that even if I'm very, very careful, there's still a claim against me if he's not careful.
And the reason for that was exactly your very first point and your first impression, that this is not based on the action of the owner. It's based on the activity.
I know, and I understand that's your position, which is different than opposing counsel's position.
Justice Segre.
I was basically going to ask what Justice Crooks just did. The liability is yours because of the activity. The liability isn't based upon a negligent hiring or something like that, right?
That is exactly right.
So you're saying my knowledge of the inherent dangerousness is sort of irrelevant. I would think most people would, the things you hire people to do are the things that you don't want to take on yourself because you don't know what you're doing, right? So that's pretty much going to be every time you hire somebody, whether it's to mow your lawn, paint your house, spray some bug spray, to whatever it might be, it's probably going to be something outside of the realm of a homeowner's normal something they would feel comfortable doing, right? So
certainly they
what
may.
Wouldn't be inherently dangerous?
Well, I think that what would not be inherently dangerous, the first most obvious one is just driving. There's case law that says that's a risk to the general public that's not peculiar to the activity. I think that's what you have to focus on. So mowing the lawn would not be inherently dangerous, shoveling the sidewalk. In many cases, I know that Wagner says construction is inherently dangerous, but for purposes of applying this law, in many cases, construction or demolition would not be, in the sense of the example I used with Justice Gableman before. If there's not some inherent danger in the construction or the demolition that is likely in the very conducting of the activity to cause damage to someone else, it's not inherently dangerous then.
Let me just say that we have to start out, don't we, with the concept that the law determines liability. So the law has the common law, judge-made common law, has determined that if you have a dangerous thing like a bull or a big pool of water, then you're strictly liable if something goes wrong. You may have been absolutely not negligent, but that's the law that's developed. Now we can change the law. It's judge-made law. The law provides if you're negligent, you're liable. Right? And the law, common law, has provided what negligence is below the reasonable standard, right? The third law that has been provided in the cases, as I understand, Mr. Terwilliger and you, is that if it's inherently dangerous, the law is imposing on you the liability for a negligent independent contractor. That is the law. Now, if the court doesn't like that law that has developed under the common law, it can change it because it's judge-made law. Have I set forth the doctrines appropriately?
Well, I think you have. Of course, changing, I mean, we learn in the first year of law school, stare decisis means something, and
right.
that we have to have a compelling reason
right.
if we're going
right.
to change the law right. and upset the stability of the law.
But it's important to point out that the existing law is what I have just stated.
If that is correct.
And the courts developed that common law because as you started this argument, someone is going to bear the burden of loss. And the court said, who should bear it? the person who hired properly this independent contractor and can protect through insurance, should they bear the loss or should the neighboring property or whoever is the victim bear the loss when they might not have been able to have any way of protecting themselves, right?
That is true.
And the law said, you who hired the independent contractor bear the loss, even though generally you don't.
Correct.
So your view is, should the court change that law now?
No, you should not. That's our argument.
That's the stare decisis. And it has a good, the principle is still good in modern America.
Yeah, I don't see that it is, that anything has changed as that law is well developed in Wisconsin and throughout the restatement. And I don't see anything has changed that would say that that is no longer a good principle.
And the court doesn't even have to decide whether or not that's a question of fact or law as to whether this is inherently dangerous because, one, the facts are undisputed, so application of this law to undisputed facts is a question of law, or you can also argue that the law in Wisconsin is that herbicides are dangerous because of the administrative law provisions that you cited.
And the Butler cases, yeah,
the
as
Butler
well.
Cases. Yes.
I have a question based on Mr. Terwilliger's observation that negligent hiring has never been alleged here in this instance. Is that right?
That's true. That was not alleged.
And then to your responses to Justices Crooks and Justice Ziegler, what did the Court of Appeals mean, in your estimation, in its remand order when it said, however, the factual question remains for the jury to determine whether Luthi exercised ordinary care to prevent damage to the Brandenburg's property?
That is a very good question. When I first read the opinion, I had the same question, and I quite frankly had to dig into that to figure that out, because obviously if you are found liable without any negligence, vicarious liability, there would not be the need for that question.
He's guilty, and now right. We'll have the trial.
Right. So with all due respect to the Court of Appeals, after I researched it, I think that it's just not written terribly clearly, but I think what they meant is because that sentence refers to the jury civil jury instruction. And what that sets forth is a number of questions to be asked, one being, was the owner negligent? Now, the only way that could be interpreted, if you follow through the sequence of the jury instruction, is the jury's been instructed that the owner is negligent for, is liable for the negligence of the independent contractor, and that has to be what that question
if
means.
If the activity was inherently dangerous.
Exactly. That's the only thing that can mean logically.
But that begs a question that several other justices have kind of alluded to, and I guess I'll ask it directly. How is someone then in Mr. Luthi's position to protect himself if you say he went and hired the finest herbicide specialist in all of Christendom, and he went out of his way to make sure that the guy was bonded and made sure that his equipment was the latest equipment, and all of the employees of the independent contractor were certified, and you get one, obviously. So then, you know, he's done everything and more that a person in his position could do to ensure that he's hired the right guy to do the job without damaging. And by the way, to add to it, he specifically said, my neighbors have these really nice trees, and they have a lot of them, and I don't want any damage, so please, under no conditions, take a risk then. Liable.
And by adding that last provision, you've added basically section 413 there, I think, of the restatement, where it says, you know, did they take adequate measures to protect against it, but 416 and 427 says it doesn't matter because it's, again, the activity. So The question is, what else could Lethe do to protect himself? You have to compare it to what the neighboring owner can do. And what Lethe can do that the neighboring owner can't do, doing all the things that you said, plus he can insure as homeowners and ranch owners or whatever it is, farmers insurance, plus he can investigate the insurance of the contractor itself. So he has all of those elements to protect him that the neighboring owner doesn't have. Now, the question then becomes, okay, he does all of that, still gets sued. Well, now he's protected because he's insured against the risk. The risk has been placed upon him because the law says it's better to place it on him than on the neighbor. Because the activity ultimately benefits him. He's ultimately made the decision to conduct the activity. It always comes back to that.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just to clarify that a little bit more, when I look at the decision of the Court of Appeals, not only do they remand with the language that was referred to earlier, but they specifically refer to instruction 1022.6. So that gives you the question that would be asked. And as I look at that question, it's basically this. If you answered question one having to do with inherent danger, then answer this question. Did the owner fail to use ordinary care in the work that was described? Is that basically what the issue would be then on remand?
No, because...
Why not?
The reason is because if you ask both questions, then you've inserted another element into the inherently dangerous exception, that being that the owner himself, in this case, was negligent. And the negligence of the owner, in this case, is not at issue. It's the negligence of the independent contractor. So the only way that you can square the language in the Court of Appeals decision with this civil jury instruction is to ask the first question, was it inherently dangerous? Now, under the law, once you answer that one yes, then the next question has to be, was the contractor negligent? And then that negligence would flow through to the owner.
Well, that's under Form 2. First of all, I find these instructions they're difficult to read, partially because the instruction uses the term owner/principal contractor when there really are two different people.
The owner/principal contractor?
Yes. So if you look at the suggested verdict forms under 1022.6, the first one says, was the work performed by the owner, in parentheses, principal contractor, inherently dangerous? In our case, it's principal contractor.
No. The owner principal contractor, and this supports our argument that you should not draw a line around a pure owner. Kolb, the dynamite case, makes it clear that the relationship of owner to independent contractor is the same as principal or general contractor to subcontractor. So I think that the jury instruction there is saying either the owner or the principal contractor.
To pick. Don't you have to pick one?
Yes.
Okay,
yes.
Which one would you pick in this
owner
case?
Owner in this case. Yes.
Okay, that's what I'm trying to say. You'd
I'm
have
sure.
to pick one. So was the work performed by the owner inherently dangerous? And what it means here is the owner is getting herbicide distributed, right? And
right.
Is that dangerous? Okay. Then number two in that says, did the owner fail to use ordinary care? Now, all of a sudden, in one, the instructions give the judge and the litigants a choice between owner and principal. And in two, it switches only to the owner. But if you look at Form 2, which is the bottom part, it says, contract to prevent injury or damage. I don't know what that means. Did the contract between the third person, who's the third person? The independent contractor?
The third
and
person.
The owner.
So I have a hard time figuring all that out. Require the he, she, it. Who's the he, she, or it?
I agree that the jury...
it's not your fault. It's just that I'm looking at this. and I'm having trouble understanding if I were the trial judge. The whole point, all the instructions always say to the trial judge, you've got to do the instructions to fit the facts of the case. So when you got things in parentheses or brackets, you have to pick one or two or whatever it is. And so I have a difficult time here picking them. So I don't know what the instruction was. Have we gotten to the instructions here yet? No.
No,
it's summary judgment. So we haven't gotten any of that. We're using this as a summary of the law. So I have a little difficulty with understanding that. Now, I'll tell you how I read the sentence.
There's also
4
and 3.
Yeah, there's a 4 and 3. Just as Brooks points out to me and a 4 and 3 for the special verdict. So I really don't know when that fits either. I read that sentence to mean that you got to go, even if you say here that Mr. Luthi stays in the case and therefore goes to the next step. The next step is to find out if Luthi is liable vicariously, which means you look to whether the contractor was negligent or not. Because as to Luthi, that's a vicarious liability issue. And that's what I think that means. Because no one here is fighting that they can't sue the contractor for negligence. That's not in this case. It's not in the opinion. So that's how I interpreted it. But I don't know that I'm right.
I think that's exactly right. I think it's the only way you can interpret it without inserting something into the law that isn't there at the next level when it goes back down to the trial court. I did want to address the...
Could I ask, how does strict liability factor in here? Is the owner, is it strict liability if there's you have an inherently dangerous activity?
No.
No.
Strict liability would be that you're liable even without any negligence at all. And in this case, there has to be the negligence of the independent contractor. So I think... I think that's the difference between inherently dangerous activity and extra hazardous activity. Is the extra hazardous attaches the strict liability?
Okay, so the independent contractor has defenses, but the owner doesn't. He rides on the back of the independent contractor.
Right. He has the same defenses that the independent contractor had. And again, because we're focusing on the activity and placing the burden on the owner who made the decision to do the inherently dangerous activity as opposed to the third party.
But you've indicated that the owner can look to the independent contractor for want to call it subrogation.
Indemnification.
Indemnification.
Yes. Yes. I did want to address the cold case. That's the dynamite case. I'm not going to address that because with the argument now that we should just make the distinguishment with homeowners, then I don't think that is no longer, that's not an issue anymore. So what I'll address instead is to get back to the point as does it make sense to just say a pure owner? I'm a farm boy, and so, number one, I do know somebody was taking care of those cows in some fashion. But number two, there is, where are we going to draw the line then? And we can have a farmer who has 600 acres that she or he is farming, and they don't have any employees. And they know way more about spraying insecticide than a lot of people. And are we just going to say because they're an owner and that don't happen to have any employees that they're not going to be... liable under this rule, when their neighbor who happens to hire two employees to help milk the cows is liable under this rule? It just, this distinction the line where the Leafy is arguing to have it drawn just does not make sense. Final thing I wanted to talk about is the peculiar knowledge. Section 413 actually is relevant under Section 416. Section 413 of Second Restatement of Torts. And it's only relevant to Section B because that's where 416B says it's relevant, is B. And it specifically says, peculiar does not mean that the risk must be one which is abnormal to the type of work done, or that it must be abnormally great risk. It has reference only to a special recognizable danger arising out of the work itself, which, as I indicated earlier in this spraying, simply means that the spray was the expected inherent danger of spray is that it will get on the neighbor's property and cause further damage. With that, because that's the only argument left here, I will close unless there's any other questions.
The inherent danger is that, by definition, it's a killer. The herbicide is a killer.
It's intended to kill something, yes.
And that you can't contain it. It's not like you're putting it into a bottle and you can seal the bottle. The end. It spreads. And so that's why cases hold that it's inherently dangerous.
That's exactly right, and why I think the legislature, through the Department of Agriculture, has determined it's inherently dangerous. Thank you.
Could I ask,
Prosser,
the independent contractor, if the independent contractor uses ordinary care, and the jury finds that the independent contractor uses ordinary care, then the 71 trees that are dead don't matter. Is that right?
That's right. And the court may have wondered why I tried to preserve the extra hazardous issue here. And the reason for that is this case, the posture that it's taken to get here was summary judgment, and then the argument was totally about whether it was inherently dangerous or extra hazardous was the proper rule, and then there was some mistake made as to applying inherently dangerous at the trial court level. We have Briarwood here, the third party, that's saying, you know, we're not negligent. We put this stuff on. We did everything right, and it killed the trees. Well, if that's the case, that's why I made the point, even if we would change the law here and somehow Leafy would not be responsible under the inherently dangerous rule, Leafy still has to stay in the case because Briarwood's preserving this defense that they were not negligent. Now, we've got a finding by the state legislature through the administrative code that it is not an acceptable risk to damage your neighbor's property when you spray your own property. So if that's not an acceptable risk, and if this stuff is so potent that the contractor did everything right and it still killed the trees, then it, by definition, is extra hazardous and there still has to be a recovery. We're not asking to overturn the Court of Appeals. We agree it's inherently dangerous, but it's the posture of the case that puts us in this position.
So if I hear you correctly in response to Justice Prosser, you want the case to carefully state that what the inherently dangerous rule is, but that at the same time is a rule on extra hazardous, and we don't deal with it in this particular opinion.
Right. I don't think you have to deal with that if you...
No, but you don't want it closed out.
Correct. Correct. And a fair question may be, well, wait a minute, Mr. Arndt, you're relying on Butler, and Butler specifically says it's inherently dangerous but not extra hazardous. The difference in Butler is that the damage in that occurred when the honeybees came onto the owner's property. So the legislative determination that spraying so that it gets off the property is an unacceptable risk doesn't apply in Butler. Thank you.
Justice Justice Gossett, do you have a follow-up? Mr. Chair, Mr. Barnett, you are going to do the rebuttal.
Excuse me. Yeah, may it please the court, Attorney Timothy J. Burnett for Robert Luthy and McMillan Warner. I want to address right off the bat this extra hazardous issue. And there's no question it's not in front of this court right now because it wasn't raised on a cross petition. But when we go down, the Court of Appeals opinion on that point is law of the case at a minimum. I don't want to get into whether it's somehow permanently waived. I don't think that's before us. But you can't have something that's inherently dangerous as a matter of law and might be extra hazardous. The two definitions are fundamentally incompatible. The one as applied by the Court of Appeals is that there are special precautions that need to be taken to minimize the risk to an acceptable level. And they found as a matter of law that all the experts agreed there are risks, unique risks in using these herbicides, but if you take certain precautions, you cannot eliminate the risk, but you minimize it. That's inherently dangerous. Extra hazardous is when nothing you can do can make it safe. And this sort of, what if they're not negligent, then it has to be extra hazardous. This has come up a couple times before. We've had the same answer. That wasn't briefed in the Supreme Court here, but that the answer is that negligence isn't strict liability. So if Briarwood, the risks only have to be minimized. They don't have to be eliminated. Those minimal risks are still a minimal risk that negligence, that in the absence of negligence, harm will still apply. In any case, I would like to then clarify inherently dangerous. The case law in Wisconsin and elsewhere uses different phrases and concepts, but they really have coalesced. And I don't disagree with Attorney Arndt's statement that it's about the activity in question, and it doesn't necessarily have to have a risk of catastrophic destruction. It is whether there is a peculiar risk or special precaution that needs to be taken. A peculiar risk involved or a special precaution that needs to be taken. And I don't have the specific cases that talk about it this way, but I think the easiest way is to simply read from the restatement third. And this is comment B to section 59, which talks about the coalescing of the concept and says, under the restatement, an activity poses a peculiar risk when, if reasonable care is not taken, the resulting risk differs from the types of risks that are usual in the community. That's where we're getting that from. In any case, I want to then be very clear about what we're asking.
Let me interrupt you for just a minute. Do you view, when this goes back on remand, that there would be a separate determination as to whether or not the contractor was negligent and a separate determination as to whether or not the owner of the property, Mr. Luthy, was negligent?
No, because there's no direct claim for actual active negligence on behalf of Luthy. It's only vicarious liability.
So you think they're directly tied one to the other?
Correct. Under the Court of Appeals opinion, what we're asking is to say, either as an exception to the inherently dangerous rule, that it does not apply to a non-employer. And I think that not the employer status is key. Regardless of whether he sold cattle, what matters here is that an employer is regularly experienced at evaluating what someone else is telling them about something they don't know, about a peculiar risk, and determining whether they're full of it or not. And whether what they're saying makes sense. A normal person is not familiar with it. An employer might at least have an opportunity to be familiar with things like insurance coverage. But a normal person.
Does that mean that, you know, there is an employer case that deals with where an employee is injured and what the rules should be?
Right, and that would be extra hazardous. Excuse me.
Okay.
That would be extra hazardous.
And is that what you're asking here?
We are not asking to say that extra hazardousness would not apply to an employee. If Robert Luthy asked...
You're asking that extra hazardous apply to a neighbor.
Yes, that would work.
Saying use the employee rule for a private owner
Correct.
Of property. That's how I have always heard you.
Okay. Correct.
Counsel, oh, I'm sorry. Were you done? Were you done answering the Chief Justice?
Yes, I was. Yes.
All right, that's what I thought.
Let the record show he nodded his head in the affirmative.
And then said yes. You started out by saying you were going to quote from the Restatement Third of Torts. That's, did you mean to say that, or are you quoting from Restatement
yes.
Second?
No, Restatement Third, just because it's more convenient to do that than to get it. What has happened, and I'm not asking you guys to adopt, the Restatement Third is consistent with the Restatement Second as we've cited it.
Okay.
It was not cited until the reply brief. It was just, it's easier to explain because what the Restatement Third has done is taken 413, is taken the several sections from the Restatement Second and put them into one section.
Okay. Thank you.
So you want the owner to be treated like an employer?
That was the one, because there are different doctrinal ways of getting the same result that I was going to try to explain, but I'm evidently out of time.
Okay. You were asking for extra hazardous, not inherently dangerous.
Right. Or to, just quickly, to apply the knowledge requirements from all the restatement sections. The restatement sections have been applied in Wisconsin, just not knowledge, and look to that, which in some cases could be a question of fact, but here the facts are undisputed. Third is to look at both of these factors, whether that he is not an employer and that he does not have knowledge of the specific risks here, the peculiar risks, and say that because of those two things, even if liability attaches, or even if negligence and vicarious liability could apply, public policy protects him.
So the only thing that the owner can get capped for if the independent contractor if the independent contractor's action are for extra hazardous activities.
True. That's assuming that the owner was not negligent in hiring the independent contractor in the first place.
Right, right.
And I think when we talk about if you have a homeowner who's just a homeowner, but somehow is an expert on asbestos, or an expert on herbicides, and they hire someone who does the exact wrong thing, that would seem like a decent claim for negligent hiring to me.
Okay, so it's really key on how you classify the activity in regard to what the homeowner can be on the hook for from your theory.
Right, and I think that matters because, for instance, let's talk about herbicides, and, you know, if the general proposition that herbicides harm vegetation is the inherent danger here, then you can't hire someone to spray Scott's weed and feed because that will harm some vegetation, including some you might not mean to. I mean, that's why you have to define it as, in this case, the specific risk is the unique stuff that people don't know, which is that at certain temperatures and humidities, a liquid can become a gas and make itself much more mobile.
Any other questions?
Thank you,
Counsel. On behalf of the court, let me say I appreciate the arguments of all three counsel here on what might have been a case in a first-year court casebook. And that was a good year for me, so I'm delighted to revisit it. That ends the hearing on 2012 AP 2085, Kelly Brandenburg versus Robert Liffey. The court will be in recess for lunch until 1:30, when it will hear the third case on today's schedule and the last case currently scheduled for the month of January. We are in recess.